Chapter 23, The Byrd Antarctic Expedition. In America, I had the Irish emigrant's choice of occupation, contracting or politics. They are related, as I quickly discovered. I chose contracting as the lesser evil, and dropped both anchors in Long Island. But a life of routine and pattern was more than I could stomach, and I was ready for the first whisper of a foreign ill wind that boded trouble. My first attempt to break the doldrums was a fiasco. Chinese agents for Chiang Kai-shek in New York had arranged for me to handle a naval maneuver of my own planning, and I was sent post-haste to China. But Chinese political intrigue is even more difficult than Irish. There were internal dissensions. Chiang was walking the fence between the support of the Sung millions and the Soviet. He finally married the Sung heiress, as gold was necessary to pay his soldiers in order to hold their loyalty. The Canton group offered me a choice of posts, but the political change of front of the leaders reminded me too much of the Irish betrayal. I rejected all offers and returned to Los Angeles, California. After a couple of months in Hollywood, where I was employed in rigging a sailing ship on the lots, I returned to New York determined to settle down. With a partner, I started in earnest as a building contractor, capitalizing my experience as an engineer during the war. My ambitions were high and my nerve was good. I built an aeroplane factory for J.V. Martin, an ex-British sea captain and pioneer of aviation in America. He had been flying and constructing planes since 1911. The factory was at Mitchell Field, Long Island. Seeing flying becoming more popular, I conceived the brilliant plan of flying direct to Ireland. This was years before the feats of Lindbergh, Byrd, etc. But money was hard to raise, and Martin and I had to bow before economics. Our dreams were the only thing that soared. Coming home one night from an arduous day's work on a construction job, I had my bath and dinner before retiring to the sun porch for a quiet read, as was my nightly custom. Next door, a radio was blaring full blast, and as I felt my annoyance growing, I heard the announcer of the Daily News Service indistinctly stating, "It is estimated that the expedition will take 2 years to complete the work outlined by Commander Byrd. The expedition is only in the preparatory stage, but already Commander Byrd had over 50,000 applications for..." I could hear no more, but what I heard was enough. I sent out for the morning paper and all the back copies available in the paper store. That evening, I located the article I wanted. It outlined Commander Byrd's plans to attack the Antarctic by air, culminating in a flight to the South Pole and back. 50,000 applicants, I thought. Well, I'd take a chance. I wrote to the commander, giving him a brief outline of my qualifications and stating the class of certificates I held. A week later, I had a reply of acknowledgement. The picking of suitable officers had been deferred. Should he consider my application, he would let me know when and where an interview would be held. Antarctica had always interested me. It was off the beaten track. Brave men had perished trying to wrest secrets from its icy bosom. To gain first-hand knowledge of any place, there is no better method than to go there. Building became hateful. Bricks, cement, all the dusty, dirty implements of the profession became increasingly distasteful. The wind in the rigging, the crash of waves on the side of a pitching bark kept singing through my head. My partner was worried. I was the construction engineer of the combine, and to me fell the technical problems that arise in building. I drew up the plans of work, handled the surveyor's transit, leveled off the terrain, but I made some blunders which caused delay. "It's no use, Tim," I said in reply to his anxious query about my absent-mindedness. "I've got the wretched wanderlust again. That Antarctic expedition has thrown me out of gear." 2 weeks later, when I had given up hope of ever hearing from Commander Byrd, I was seated at dinner when I noticed a slip of paper on the table. This is what I read. "Commander Byrd wants to see you in the morning, 9 o'clock, Biltmore Hotel." It was signed by the girl in the paper store with whom I shared a telephone. She was a Jewess, and Berg was easier to write than bird. Elation is a mild term. I felt I was already on my way south. 9 to the minute on the following morning, I met the commander in his suite. "Why do you want to go on the expedition?" Bird asked quickly. "I'll tell you why, Commander," I said. "There seems no hope of a decent war breaking out in the near future. Piracy is difficult to organize, and it's too hot in Nicaragua for comfortable revolution." Bird burst out laughing. "That's the queerest reason that's been put up to me yet. Say, what do you consider the best jobs you've yet accomplished? I want the truth." "Breaking Frank Carty out of prison under a death sentence. Escaping myself under similar circumstances. I consider those two good jobs." The unusual references seemed to tickle Bird immensely. "I see by your papers you're a good sailor, have held 3 commands. Guess I'll take you." He thereupon sketched out the program of organization and the part I should take in helping to get off to a good start. He had purchased an old whaler in Norway. When she arrived in New York, I should take over the task of re-rigging and fitting her out for the tough battle in the Antarctic seas. Bird and I inspected the Samson when she arrived in New York. I was disappointed in the size of the vessel for such a large undertaking. As I was accustomed to huge sailing ships, I was unconsciously prejudiced against this small barkentine. Her hull was over 3 feet thick, and the stem was sheathed in iron to plough through the ice, but her superstructure was falling to pieces with decay. She was nearly 50 years old and of antiquated pattern. I took down all the old and worm-eaten spars and unshipped the jib boom, replacing all with new, and after a couple of months the barge looked like a trim bark, with new and handsome yards crossed on the mainmast. My rating was chief officer, and I was the first to be picked. Not being an American, in truth I had no nationality, Commander Bird regretted that he could not give me command. But the public would not have tolerated a foreigner in command of a ship sailing under the stars and stripes on a mission of national importance. For myself, I would have sailed as bosun and been glad of the opportunity. Preparations were amusing. I witnessed at first hand the American love of publicity, exploitation, and general hokum. We were photographed. We told lies of former adventures, and reporters added reams of falsehoods to those given so lavishly. Lambs became raging wolves. I was credited with having commanded the Chinese Emperor's barge. A lady reporter asked me to tattoo a full-rigged ship on her arm. I compromised with a small anchor and made her the happiest girl in New York. That is, while the glamour of the expedition hung in thick clouds over the minds of the romantically inclined. The bark proved inadequate, small, slow, and primitive. Another vessel, a seized rum runner, was pressed into service. This vessel, named the Chelsea, was originally a British minesweeper, but had sunk into the channels of crime to supply the thirsty Yank with firewater. Came the great day of departure. All the Argonauts, accompanied by autograph hunters, wives, sweethearts, friends and bartenders, and the indomitable press, piled on board the bark City of New York to see us off on the first lap of our 12,000-mile journey to the Bay of Whales, Antarctica. Our newly appointed captain, with a newly appointed commission in the Naval Reserve as Lieutenant Commander, looked resplendent in a brand new uniform. Commander Bird was there, glad to get part of the cumbersome expedition underway. I was anxious to be out to sea in order to put the ship in order. Once the sails were set and watches picked, I would soon establish discipline and routine. The official welcoming tender for the Port of New York came alongside and took off all our friends and one stowaway. Later on, we discovered another stowaway up forward, a Negro youth by the name of Lanier. He made such a pitiable plea to Commander Bird that he was allowed to remain on board and promised a permanent berth in the expedition. Bird went ashore in the pilot boat. With the departure of the pilot, our last link with the United States was severed for the next 2 years. the gold-rated captain gave orders to set sail. Immediately I went about this in the approved square-rigged manner, setting the lower topsails and foresail with enough staysails to hold her up in the wind. This is where the first clash came. Melville was a schooner man and wanted only the fore and aft sails set. On a square-rigged ship, this was heresy, and I said so. We were opposite types. The ballyhoo of the expedition and the recent elevation to naval rank had gone to his head. But press-clipping was his hobby, and dreams of eclipsing everyone on the ocean kept him so busy that I had no interference in running and handling the ship. The crew were mostly volunteers. Some had never been to sea or out of the United States, but they soon became efficient enough to do what work was required willingly. In picking watches, I selected all young Americans without sea experience, so that I could train them better than my second mate, who was a Norwegian and, in an emergency, liable to give the commands in his own language. Sverstrom was a capable seaman, having learnt his profession in the turbulent seas off the North Cape in his beloved Norway. The crew was certainly mixed. It included three professors, a millionaire, a Paramount movie expert, some ex-members of the U.S. Navy, three Norwegians, Dr. Coman, a professor of John Hopkins University, Taffy Davis, a professor of McGill University, Montreal, Paul Stipple, 6-footer Boy Scout, and a few others, not so important, including Melville and myself. The watches were picked according to the old standard of 4 hours on deck and 4 hours below. As we were a voluntary body, the majority serving without pay, and sufficient in numbers to have three watches, this arrangement was criticized. It caused much discomfort to the crew and myself. The boys had thought of continuing their studies at sea, but these watches upset all plans. I was on deck all day, setting up and altering the rigging. There is a vast difference in the trim of a ship in dock and at sea. The constant rolling and pitching had slackened up the backstays, and were these not set up tight, the loss of the mast would only be a matter of time. The city of New York was a small bark of about 500 tons, built for whaling, with practically no cargo space worth mentioning. The tween decks were converted into living quarters and mess room combined. Aft were the engine room and stokehold. In a dead calm, the engines propelled a clumsy bark at the rate of 6 knots per hour. On the poop was built a special housing containing Commander Byrd's quarters, the radio shack and chart room. The decks were piled high with equipment. Every nook and cranny was full of stores. As we entered the tropical belt in the Caribbean, a mishap occurred, which caused much discomfort. Someone in the engine room let seawater into the fresh water tanks. As a result, the water became brackish, and tea and coffee had a strong salty flavor. Drinking water was at a premium, only to be obtained from the refrigerator in small quantities. There was one novel feature on this ship that greatly amused me. The men forward were decent, gentlemanly fellows who had all the refinements of sociability with the advantages of athletic training predominant in the higher seats of learning in the States. They resented the class discrimination inflicted by the captain, for to my surprise, after leaving New York, two separate messes were instituted, as is the custom on ordinary freighters. All the officers and myself chose to eat with the crew, leaving Melville to mess aft in the saloon with 4 members of the landing party. Taffy Davis, the only Britisher in the expedition, soon forsook this honour and joined the crowd below. We had exceedingly fine weather all the way to the canal. 20 days after leaving New York, we dropped anchor off the breakwater in Colon, ready to dazzle the officials of the Big Ditch with the presence of the vanguard of America's most widely advertised expedition. Captain Melville was given a rude reception. No one at expedition headquarters had anticipated the need for funds at the canal for toll and coal. When Melville was asked for cash, he was incensed. This was the great Byrd expedition. Didn't the canal authorities read the paper? The port captain was not at all impressed. No money, he said, no transit, and no coal. A fine dilemma for the latest addition to the American Navy. The captain came forward to the forecastle to raise the money. Mike Thorne, one of the sailors, paid the bill and we were allowed to enter the port of Colon to take on bunkers before going through the canal. An episode that occurred at this stage is worth recounting. Coming on board the ship in Colon, after a few hours on shore, I took a look forward to see that everything was shipshape before turning in for the night. I heard moans and whimpers ascending from the mess deck. Going down, I located in the dimly lighted compartment the coloured stowaway lanyard, manacled to a stanchion. "What does this mean?" I inquired angrily. Lanyard had been a good boy, a willing and conscientious worker. "Oh, Mr. McGinnis, help me," he sobbed. "Captain Melvin, he going to send me back to New York morning he put me in jail." The sight of the irons made me see red. I roared out to one of the sailors who had followed me down the companionway, "Rogers, get a hacksaw and cold chisel," then to Lanyard. "Now promise to hold your ground and I'll see what can be done." While Rogers cut through the leg irons, I severed the handcuffs and soon had Lanyard free. In the morning, I woke with a noise of voices in loud protestation. Going quickly up on deck, I was greeted with an amazing spectacle. A squad of canal police were hustling Lanyard ashore together with two other members of the expedition, Cummings and an assistant engineer. The other members of the expedition were hooting at and deriding the police for all they were worth. The unfortunate trio were put into a car and whisked off to jail. They had committed no crime. I asked Melville the reason for such inhumanity. "They're no damned use aboard my ship," he said in his thin nasal drawl. "I'm deporting them back to the States. Maybe there's some more that'll go before long," he added. "The ship's going to be run the way I want it to be run." I went forward in a state of bewilderment. Two of the engineers who had toiled and slaved night and day to keep the antiquated engines from falling apart were even more annoyed than I. "The second was for quitting right then and there, and they were getting no cooperation below," he said. "In fact, they were being treated as if they were enemies." I begged him to think it over and consider the success of the expedition. Things would straighten out once Bird was at the helm. This argument prevailed. After coaling and taking on water, we quit Colon and entered the canal, heading for Balboa on the Pacific side. After clearing the canal, we developed engine trouble and had to put back for repairs. While lying in Balboa, I took the opportunity to go ashore for the purpose of buying a ship's bell for aft, there being none on board. I was accompanied by Thorne, Jim Fueri, and Quinn Blackburn. While I made the purchase, the trio adjourned to a cafe to wait. There I joined them about 15 minutes later. We drank a glass of beer each, then I decided to ring up the captain of the port to find out if the repairing job was finished and the exact sailing hour. I soon had him on the wire. "When will the City of New York be ready for sea?" I asked. "Is that the chief officer?" I heard him reply excitedly. "Have you three men with you?" "Sure, they're right here." You can imagine my astonishment when he said, "The ship sailed half an hour ago. You'd better drive like hell to the pilot station and catch the boat before it leaves to take off the pilot." I waited no more. We grabbed a taxi and sped for the pilot landing about 3 miles away. The motorboat was shoving off as we dashed down to the pier. We waved and hollered and hooted with the horn of the taxi. The black coxswain heard the din and saw us waving wildly. He swung the boat around, heading for the landing steps. In a second we clambered on board and soon were speeding for the bark, slowly chug-chugging out to sea. The boys on board cheered as we came alongside. The whole scene would have made an excellent movie shot, but we missed the picturesque value of it. Not a word was said, but I guess there was lots of deep thinking. The skipper's fetish for economy, discipline, and sanctity became unbearable. He refused to recognize the time-honored custom of splicing the main brace. "This practice calls for a glass of rum after heavy work in stormy weather. Sailors tired and soaking wet expect this reward." But Melville would not permit the 18th Amendment to be violated. He refused to permit any coffee to be made or served in the galley at night or before breakfast time, a strange rule to enforce at sea. Then the fun began. Someone took cocoa from the supplies and broke into a case of Klim, which is powdered milk. Mixed with hot water, it made a palatable drink appreciated by the night watches and the men in the stokehold. One day the skipper trained his glasses upon a can floating beside the ship. He read Klim distinctly and doubtless felt the same thrill of discovery experienced by Balboa upon a peak in Darien. Without a word to anyone, he doused the cocoa supply with violent purgative and set baited chocolate in the mess decks. He quickly discovered who stole the chocolate and cocoa. Half a dozen men were in the throes of dysentery the following day. I learned of this Sherlock Holmes plan by the skipper when three of my watch were rendered hors de combat by the violence of the cathartic. All hands were summoned aft by the skipper and given a verbal thrashing for their perfidy in broaching the cargo. In the spirited harangue, the poachers were called vandals whose acts endangered the lives of the men who were to stay at the barrier. On an ordinary commercial craft, mutiny would have followed, but the crew kept its temper for fear of being sent home. That threat was a very effective whip. When he arrived in Dunedin, Bird was far from pleased with the long passage of the city of New York. It had taken 90 weary days from Hoboken to Dunedin. The bark was painfully slow, and in the doldrums along the equator we wallowed along at 1 or 2 knots an hour. Mike Thorne and other members of the crew often swam beside the craft, and on one occasion Thorne tied a towline around his waist, fastened to the bobstay under the bowsprit, and swam ahead of the bark like a tugboat. The skipper was indignant at such an ironic challenge to our progress down the Pacific. Melvin and I often crossed swords on matters of seamanship and the course we should take. The fuel was running out. The captain wanted to go to Pago Pago for coal. I insisted we went to Tahiti. A detour to the American possession would have delayed us several weeks, and Bird was already worried about the slow progress of the ship. Melville's patriotism and false economy got the better of his common sense. Coal could be had for $1 a ton cheaper in Pago Pago. Why be robbed by the French? I reminded him of the generous treatment we received in the last American possession we touched. He did not relish my belligerent attitude, but had no reason to attack me when Bird ordered him to go to Tahiti. The stop at Tahiti was a memorable one. The first man aboard the city of New York was the same pilot who greeted me when I was a survivor of the Pilgrim. He recalled the day the lifeboat came into Papeete 14 years previously. The Eleanor Bolling arrived at Papeete ahead of us, though she sailed out of New York a full month after the city of New York. Both crews were in a carnival mood, and so was the populace. We received a real South Sea welcome from the natives, many of whom I knew from my earlier residence in Tahiti. They came in canoes bearing fruits and flowers and were invited aboard by the chief mate, in lieu of an invitation from Melville. A party was now inevitable. The crew of the Bolling came over to join the fun. Leading the natives were a dusky princess and an American lady, both bearing champagne to celebrate our safe arrival. Fortunately, the skipper had retired, having on the preceding day spent his first night out of bed since leaving New York. The princess, with her bevy of beauties, gave impetuously to the whoopee. This was a sailor's dream come true. Champagne, tropic moon, guitars, singing and dancing. The night wore on, and the princess invited the visitors to continue the merrymaking at one of the moon-bathed pavilions. The sailors obeyed with alacrity, but duty prevented my acceptance. The party was a splendid bacchanal, marred by a single accident. The royal chateau was built on stilts and not designed to carry the weight of a score of brawny seamen. At the height of the merrymaking, the underpinning snapped and dumped the hostesses and guests into a scrambling mass. No one suffered any serious injury, but the crash terminated the first night of the carnival. Tahiti was a pleasant and riotous interlude, and the crew were rather pleased at my insistence that we coal at Papeete instead of Pago Pago, though the French, I believe, were annoyed at several brawls involving the crew and the police. A glance at the map, however, will show the real reason why I preferred to buy fuel at the French possession instead of the American. Dr. Comyn, our medico, tried to mend the breach between the captain and his few henchmen and the rest of the crew, but never quite succeeded. On November 11th, the doctor opened an Armistice Day celebration with a splendid talk. My contribution to the ceremony was short and snappy. I said, "As a participant in the war, I found it interesting at times. I regret that there are only two of us here who saw service," bowing to Comyn. "So I feel anything I might say on the subject may be misunderstood." I turned my back and walked to the other side of the poop. The chauvinistic skipper insisted on a lot of ritual nonsense to the flag and told us in a mournful voice how he once carried a shipload of rags from the West Indies on a schooner that might have become uniforms or Bibles had not the armistice interfered. He forbade any drinking as a toast to the memory of the dead. Liquor was vulgar, the day too sacred to sully with it. Paul Sipple, the Boy Scout, and I had many companionable hours in the study of astronomy, the elements of seamanship, and the catching of albatross. Sipple was an exceptionally fine fellow and every inch a man. By the time we reached New Zealand, he could pass muster with the average experienced seaman, having the groundwork of simple navigation thoroughly implanted in theory and practice. There were many amusing and many tiresome incidents after leaving Tahiti, but we were all sick and tired of the pettiness that was inserted into every move from aft. Melville's rage when I brought a cup of coffee to the man standing soaked to the skin at the wheel was an example. He demanded cash for postage stamps, censored radiograms, threatened dismissal. No wonder, then, that the sight of Otago Heads, the entrance to the harbour at Dunedin, was a welcome sight. It seemed an age since the echoes of the sirens and whistles ceased in New York Harbour. But it was just 90 days,